This is Luke 13:31-35. At that very hour, some religious leaders came and said to Jesus, "Get away from here, for Herod wants to kill you." He said to them, "Go and tell that fox for me. Listen, I'm casting out demons and performing cures today and tomorrow, and on the third day I finish my work. Yet today, tomorrow, and the next day, I must be on my way, because it is impossible for a prophet to be killed away from Jerusalem. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it, how often have I desired to gather your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you were not willing. See, your house is left to you. And I tell you, you will not see me until the time comes when you say, 'Blessed is the one who comes in the name of God.'"
The second reading, this is the words to a song, "Rosie the Riveter," by Red Evans and John Jacob Loeb, 1942. While other girls attend their favorite cocktail bar, sipping martinis, munching caviar, there's a girl who's really putting them to shame. Rosie is her name. All the day long, whether rain or shine, she's part of the assembly line. She's making history, working for victory. Rosie the Riveter keeps a sharp lookout for sabotage, sitting up there on the fuselage. That little frail can do more than a male will do, Rosie the Riveter. Rosie's got a boyfriend, Charlie. Charlie, he's a Marine. Rosie is protecting Charlie, working overtime on the riveting machine. When they gave her a production E, she was as proud as a girl could be. There's something true about red, white, and blue, about Rosie the Riveter. Everyone stops to admire the scene, Rosie at work on the B-19. She's never twittery, nervous, or jittery, Rosie the Riveter. What if she's smeared full of oil and grease, doing her bit for the old land lease? She keeps the gang around. They love to hang around Rosie the Riveter. Rosie buys a lot of war bonds. That girl really has sense. Wishes she could purchase more bonds, putting all her cash into national defense. Senator Jones, who is in the know, shouted these words on the radio. "Berlin will hear about, Moscow will cheer about, Rosie the Riveter."
One of the most popular hero myths in our culture is that of the reluctant hero, the anti-hero, the person who, in a moment's time or maybe in a flash that was unexpected, reaches down within themselves and does something that they never planned to do and makes everything come out okay. We love those characters in our movies and in our novels. They're much more likable than those who set out to be the hero, who set out to do the right thing. These are those that don't necessarily do that and sometimes are running away from that and yet do that. When Maria was sharing her prayer today about the person that rescued her cousin from a burning vehicle, that is that same kind of person. It's really interesting when you think about how we are as human beings and our human nature, that it is core to our being to be selfish. And I don't mean that in a negative way like original sin, but think about an infant that didn't crave immediately for the breast, for nurture, for life. It is a grabbing kind of thing that is required of not just humans, but all species in order to survive. And so it seems almost unnatural to move away from that which could put your own life in peril. Except that parents, people to become parents, often figure out real quickly from the moment that their child is born, things shift. No longer is it their own life that is the main focus of preservation, but it's they would do anything for their child. But you don't have to be a parent to have that. There are incidences over and over again. We read them in the paper. We see them on the news. They make us cry. When someone who doesn't know any of the people involved in a terrible situation will suspend whatever they're doing and suspend their own self-interest to go in and try to take care of someone else. And sometimes they die in the process. It's a reminder that we are incredibly complicated beings. That yes, we have that self-preservation instinct that is so interwoven in our DNA. But we also have this need for community. This sense that we are bigger than ourselves. That this world is bigger than just my own self-interest. The reason I'm going on about this is because every year in Lent, approaching the crucifixion of Jesus, I try to wrap my mind around someone like Jesus who would, as the scripture said today, point his head toward Jerusalem, knowing inevitably what would come from that. Where does that come from? How do you give up the possibility for a life? When you read Martin Luther King's speech in Memphis, and you see the struggle, and you realize that he didn't want to go to Memphis. They told him not to go to Memphis. The death threats had become insurmountable. And yet there was something in him that said, I must do this. I must go to Memphis and speak out. And of course we know that that was when he was shot and killed. The same story can be said about Gandhi and many, many others who have taken that step into courage. What's curious to me is that in our Christian tradition, we often talk about the people like Martin Luther King, but we forget to talk about the women who have chosen these same kinds of paths. So for the next 3 weeks, I'm going to be talking about wicked women. Women who, I guess you could say, and wicked, I mean in two ways. Wicked like cool, as it is used today, but also in recognition that at the time that they were going through this, and the charges that were trumped up about them, they were portrayed as evil people, as witches in the negative sense of the word witch, and how it was used as a slam against people. Trumped up charges that would get them killed. Today is a mystic that you may never have heard of. This woman with her powerful picture on the front. Take a look at her. Notice that this woman, Perpetua, is African-American. African, not African-American. She is from North Africa. She's also holding a child. Let me tell you a little bit about Perpetua. She was only 22 years old when she was killed. She was rounded up in a group of early Christians who decided that their faith was so important. And part of what we see in her story is that she was resisting not just, she wasn't just being a Christian witness when it was illegal in Rome, she was standing against the violence of the Roman Empire. She believed that the way Rome did things was wrong and spoke out about that. She and a group of other people were gathered together and placed in prison. And her father must have been a Roman citizen, for he tried to, because she was had a small baby, tried to get her a better cell, and managed to do that somehow. And so she was moved to a different cell where she could nurse the baby and not worry too much about other things going on. She and several other people were in the same prison, and even though she was taken off to be alone, she still had to face the same fate, ultimately. What they did is they gathered them all together, all of these people, and there was another woman named Felicity. Felicity was a slave woman, not Perpetua's slave, but a slave woman, also from North Africa, and she was pregnant. And there was, believe it or not, there were rules about killing people. And one of the rules is that you could not kill someone who was pregnant, and you could not kill a baby, which meant that Perpetua's little baby would be saved, even though she wouldn't. And this woman, Felicity, wanted to be able to stand for her faith and face whatever was ahead, and was concerned that all of her friends would be taken off and killed, and she wouldn't be. Isn't that interesting? But she had her baby just before it was time for them to face their killers. They were all taken into an arena. It was to be a public spectacle. It was to be an example of how not to be, and if you continue to do this kind of thing, you will face the same fate. And so all of these people were gathered in, and there are multiple stories about what happened, but they were stabbed first with swords to weaken them, and then the men in the group had released around them lions who ripped them apart. And the women were wild bulls were placed in the arena who would gore them. And they were all killed in front of people. What's remarkable about Perpetua, there were other martyrs and other women who had been martyrs before, but she kept a diary, and it's the first recorded female in Christian history who wrote about the experience of being in jail in anticipation of being killed. And like Martin Luther King in Memphis, she wanted to go on. And her father came back and forth to the jail trying to persuade her to give up her Christian views so she could be spared. But she felt convicted. She had had a vision of a ladder that was like Jacob's ladder, a golden ladder, that somehow she was climbing and there would be embraced by Christ at the top of that ladder. And so had the confidence that even though she was scared to death, that it was going to be okay somehow, that it was going to be all right. What I'm fascinated by is how most of us tell these stories, we hear these stories, but never have to face anything like this. And I wonder, how would I be in this situation? If my father came to me and said, you know, think of all the good you could do if you stayed alive. She was 22 years old. Think of all those years ahead and being a mother, and, or being a father, and being a parent, taking care of your child? Would I have gone, you know, you're right. I think that's a good idea. Would I have found a justification for slipping through that conviction? I don't know the answer to that because that is something I've never faced. But I find it powerful to see someone like Perpetua and Felicity and Gandhi and Martin Luther King and Oscar Romero, people who knew the inevitable but continued to stand for their convictions. I want to say something about the passage that was read from the Gospels today. When Jesus pointed his head toward Jerusalem, the way that verse has been traditionally interpreted is that it was the Jews who crucified Jesus. You all have probably heard that story, that it wasn't a Roman crucifixion. Pilate, in fact, is portrayed often in the Gospels as really not wanting to do it, like somehow the Jews had control of Pilate. Just so you know, that is not history. That is an interpretation of the later church trying to come to grips with being alive in the Roman Empire and pushing back against Judaism. And so when it talks about, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, there are hymns written, there are cantatas written. Wagner, who was a Nazi, wrote an incredible song about this, making Jesus feel convicted that he had to go place himself into the hands of his own people who would destroy him and destroy God to preserve their own ways. And yet we see in this text a hint that it was otherwise. The religious leaders, and it's the Pharisees in particular in this text, that say to Jesus, don't go to Jerusalem. Herod has it out for you. Now, everyone knows historically that Herod was a Jew. But in those days, there were certain regional leaders, and the Romans were so creative, they knew that they could employ Roman provincial leaders who were of the people to do the dirty deeds. It's always been that way. It happens in every culture. It happened in that culture. And so Herod got very, very rich by complying with Pilate and Pilate's wishes. Make no mistake, Pilate was in charge. And Jesus knew that in the weeks ahead, Pilate would be going to Jerusalem to make a statement on the Passover to say, you guys went through this liberation thing once before out of Egypt, but don't get your hopes up. It's not happening again. We are in charge. Jesus made a decision to go to Jerusalem knowing that he would get there at the same time as Pontius Pilate. What is it about his convictions that said it's time to do this? So I want to take it to one more level and ask about martyrdom a little bit. Talk about martyrdom. When Jesus went to Jerusalem, what was going on in his head? If the kingdom of heaven, let me give you an example. If Jesus believed that the kingdom of heaven is already at hand, what would he have to gain by having himself killed? If he wasn't going there to overthrow Rome, why would he step into that arena, knowing that its inevitable result would be his own death? We don't know the answer to that. But my own personal belief is that in his conviction of nonviolence, there was this sense that even though he couldn't himself bring about the kingdom in that moment, for him to back down from his principles and his values would be teaching the wrong thing to those who followed him. That he knew that he had to do that even if it led to his death. Martyrdom is not, I mean, I suppose there are those that say, I'm going to go get martyred. I don't think that's what Martin Luther King was doing. I don't think that's what Oscar Romero was doing. I don't think that's what Perpetua was doing. And I don't think that's what Jesus was doing. I think they were so convicted for their principles, their values, their understanding that Rome, that the kingdoms of this world were not in charge, but that God was somehow in charge, that they had to take that step. And I believe that that is what we, by making the crucifixion all about what Jesus did for us, is a way for us to opt out of pointing our own heads toward Jerusalem. If Lent means anything today, it's to not bury ourselves in the history of this text, but to ask, what is Jerusalem today? What is Rome today? Who are the Pilates in our culture? And where are we on that spectrum? Are we part of the crowd that avoids getting involved? Or are we those who walk with Jesus and point our own heads toward Jerusalem? I'm not talking about a death wish. I'm talking about conviction. And I'm going to be honest here. When I say, are you willing to point your head toward Jerusalem? I have to admit that I don't know sometimes if I'm willing to do that because it's so scary. I have known of times in my life when I have been confronted with the opportunity to speak up rather than remain silent. And I just stood there, remaining silent. So I have no illusions about this. But I also have no illusions that if we want this story, this Easter story, to be real today, we can't just make it about what happened 2,000 years ago. We've got to unpack it in our present day and ask if we are willing to be a Perpetua, a Felicity, an MLK, a Jesus. Amen.